Hello, this is Terry Burdick reading to you today from the Danville Commercial News, the weekend edition for Saturday, April 4th and Easter Sunday, April 5th. We'll start our time together today on the front page with an appropriate headline, Holy Weekend. Pope Leo XIV carries cross for full Good Friday procession. And this comes to us from Colleen Berry and Tricia Thomas of the Associated Press. Dateline Rome. Pope Leo XIV carried a wooden cross for all of the 14 stations of the Way of the Cross at the Colosseum on his first Good Friday as pontiff, marking the first time in decades that a pope carried the cross to every station. I think it will be an important sign because of what the pope represents, a spiritual leader in the world today, and for his voice that everyone wants to hear that says Christ still suffers, Leo told reporters this week outside of the papal retreat at Castel Gandolfo. I carry all of this suffering in my prayer. Inside the Colosseum, Leo lifted the cross and began the rite flanked by two torchbearers who accompanied him from inside the Colosseum through the crowd outside and up the steep stairs to the Palatine Hill where he gave the final blessing. At the first station marking the moment Jesus was condemned to death, the meditation prepared, especially for Leo's first Good Friday, underlined that those with authority will have to answer to God for how they exercise their power. The power to judge, the power to start or end a war, the power to instill violence or peace, the power to refuel the desire for revenge, or for power to fuel the or for reconciliation, read the meditation written by Reverend Francesco Patton, who was custodian of the Holy Land 2016 to 2025, charged among other things of looking after sacred sites. Some 30,000 faithful gathered outside the pagan monument, following the stations as they were recited over loudspeakers. This included Sister Pelinatita Kioma Finau from Samoa and a member of the Missionary Sisters of the Society of Mary. We've been part of our parish stations of the cross, but this is so exciting. It was very meaningful to have the experience of being with the people of Rome on this special occasion, she said. Past processions. John Paul II carried the cross for the entire procession for his first Good Friday as pontiff in 1979 until his hip surgery in 1995 when he carried it just part of the way, according to AP reports of the time. For the first 2 years of his papacy, Benedict XVI carried the cross for the first station inside the Colosseum, then followed other bearers in the procession that ends on the platform of the Palatine Hill. Pope Francis never carried the cross, but participated in the procession until his death worsened. He died after a long illness last year on Easter Monday, which fell on April 21st. Pope John Paul II was just 58 when he became pope and was known as a hiker and outdoorsman. His two successors were in their late 70s when they began their papacies, and Francis was missing part of a lung due to a pulmonary infection as a young man. The Way of the Cross commemorates the final hours of Jesus' life, from his death sentence to taking up the cross to his crucifixion, death, and burial. The procession ends outside the Colosseum atop the Palatine Hill. The Way of the Cross is not intended for those who lead a priestly, pious, or abstractly recollected life, Patton wrote in his introduction. Instead, it is the exercise of one who knows that faith, hope, and charity must be incarnated in the real world. At 70, Leo is physically fit and an avid tennis player and swimmer. Before becoming pope, Leo would work out regularly at a gym near the Vatican with a plan befitting a man in his early 50s, according to his former trainer. Holy Week Activities. On Holy Saturday, the pontiff will preside over a late-night Easter vigil, during which he will baptize new Catholics and lead Roman Catholics into Christianity's most joyous celebration marking Christ's resurrection. On Easter Sunday, the Pope will celebrate an open-air Mass in St. Peter's Square before delivering his Easter message and offer the traditional Urbi et Orbi, blessing to the city of the Rome and to the world. I hope you all had a very happy Easter weekend. In local front page news, Humane Society announces new leadership. The Humane Society of Danville is moving forward with new leadership. In a media release, the Humane Society of Danville announces it is stepping into a new chapter with updated leadership, a renewed operational focus, and a continued commitment to serving animals in the Vermilion County community. After a period of transition, the organization took steps to stabilize operations and prioritize the well-being of the animals in its care. During this time, animal intake was paused to allow staff and volunteers to place animals into homes and reduce disruption. With that work now complete, the Humane Society is preparing to reopen to the public later this spring with strengthened systems and a clear path forward. The organization is pleased to announce the appointment of Sheila Knight as director. Knight, a Vermilion County native, previously served as Director of Community Programs at the Nevada Humane Society in Reno, Nevada, and recently relocated to Vermilion County. She brings extensive experience in animal welfare with a passion for community outreach and education that will help expand the Humane Society's impact locally. Joining her is Ellis Nicholson as Operations Coordinator. A graduate of the University of Illinois, Nicholson is known for her compassionate and ethical stewardship. She will play a role in building and refining internal systems to support efficient operations and long-term sustainability. The Humane Society also extends its deepest gratitude to Alyssa Julian for her 10 years of dedicated service. Julian's leadership and care have left a lasting mark in the organization and the countless animals and families she has served. Her commitment to the Humane Society and its mission has been both meaningful and enduring, and the organization is sincerely thankful for the foundation she helped build. In the coming weeks, the Humane Society of Danville will focus on evaluating internal processes, adoption procedures, and rescue procedures, establishing a consistent schedule for reopening to the public, expanding community outreach and education efforts, assessing the Second Chance Thrift Shop, including opportunities for increased hours, planning for kennel upgrades and renovations. We are grateful for a strong foundation that has been built over the years and are excited to carry that work forward, said Erica Ramsey, board president. Sheila and Ellis bring the experience, compassion, and leadership needed for this next chapter, and we look forward to reconnecting with our community in the months ahead. Community support will play a role in this next phase. Those interested in helping can, one, volunteer their time. Secondly, they can donate pet care items, and you can find a list of the needed items at www.danvillehumane.org/wishlist. You can donate to the Second Chance Thrift Shop by dropping off items during business hours between noon and 6 p.m. Wednesday, noon to 4 p.m. on Saturday, and 1 to 3 on Sunday. You can make a monetary donation at www.paypal.com and then say PayPalm HSOD, or register to become a foster provider. For updates, volunteer opportunities, and reopening information, visit danvillehumane.org. In stories of state interest, Pritzker calls for year-round E15 gasoline. And this comes to us from the Medill, Illinois News Bureau. Governor J.B. Pritzker is calling on Congress to allow the permanent year-round use of E15 gasoline, a blend of 15% ethanol and 85% gasoline that's cheaper than regular fuel and increases demand for corn. In a letter to members of the Congressional Committee on Energy and Commerce obtained by Capital News Illinois, Pritzker argued that year-round E15 would help spur domestic energy production and stabilize fuel markets. I respectfully urge you to support legislation that ensures the permanent nationwide availability of year-round E15, Pritzker wrote, adding doing so would provide certainty to the market, strengthen rural economies, and reinforce America's commitment to domestic energy production. For years, federal regulations have blocked the use of E15 during the summer months over concerns that warmer temperatures could create more smog. In April 22, 8 Midwestern states, including Illinois, opted out of a waiver that gave them access to E10 fuel in hopes of forcing the hand of Congress to authorize the sale of E15. But lawmakers have yet to reach a permanent solution, and retailers and consumers in those opted-out states have had to deal with higher costs while waiting for an emergency waiver to come in every year. Pritzker pointed to projected increases in the demand for ethanol, saying that expanded E15 access would significantly boost markets for corn growers. Projections indicate that year-round E15 could increase ethanol demand by 4.5 billion gallons between 2021 and 2035, resulting in an additional 1.5 billion bushels of corn demand, he said. At a time when farmers are still awaiting meaningful trade relief and facing elevated input costs, this kind of market expansion would provide tangible short-term support and position Illinois as a national leader in renewable fuels. The governor also pointed to broader economic pressures on the agriculture section, including the ongoing war in Iran, as a reason for already higher gas prices. According to AAA, gas prices eclipsed $4 a gallon across the country this week for the first time since 2022. The renewed push from Pritzker, who wrote to the Environmental Protection Agency in early March about the same issue along with other governors, comes as the EPA issued yet another temporary emergency waiver to allow the sale of E15 during the summer. Without this action, E15 gasoline cannot be used by roughly half of the country this summer, the EPA said in a statement announcing the issuance of the emergency waiver. Pritzker's letter comes as fuel retailers in Illinois and across the Midwest have warned that without a long-term fix, past just the summer months, the region could face even higher gas prices since there would be different fuel standards across different states. Relying on administrative action does not provide the long-term certainty that farmers, producers, fuel retailers, and consumers need, Pritzker added. We must get to work to remove this regulatory roadblock. Well, looking forward to some summer events, Cooper Allen headlines the Vermilion County Fair, and this is a staff report. For the first time ever, the Vermilion County Fair presents a national headliner. Cooper Allen, a chart-topping country music powerhouse, captivating millions with his dynamic blend of country rock, pop, and hip-hop, will be on stage Thursday, June 18th at 7 p.m. Eastern. Allen, with over 18 million followers and 750 million streams, has been recognized as a Pandora 10 Artist to Watch and Sirius XM and Pandora Future 5 pick. He rose from Nashville honky-tonks to sold-out arenas. Kicking off the night are Jake and Michaela, a Central Illinois duo, with a genre-blending country set, mixing outlaw, rockabilly, gospel, bluegrass, and more. In addition to the concert, the Vermilion County Fair set for June 13th to the 20th will also feature a demolition derby at 5 p.m. Eastern on Saturday, June 20th. The Queen and Princess crowning will be at 3 p.m. Eastern on Sunday, June 7th at the North Vermilion High School. Tickets for the concert went on sale Friday, and more information about the fair is available at vermilioncountyfair.com. It looks like there's a lot of summer events coming up. Tickets are on sale for the 2026 United We Cook. This is the staff report, Dateline Danville. The United Way of Danville area announces that tickets are on sale for United We Cook 2026. According to a release from the United Way, this is one of the community's most anticipated events, and it's set for Saturday, May 2nd at the David S. Palmer Arena in Danville. United We Cook brings together local celebrity chefs, including business leaders and community advocates, for a lively culinary competition. Guests will sample the signature dishes from each chef and cast their votes to help crown the crowd favorites. The event will run from 5 to 8 p.m., with doors opening at 4:30. Admission is $50, and all individuals must be 21 or older, as there will be a cash bar. The local chefs will have tip jars for patrons to vote for their favorites, and every dollar supports the United Way. Guests can also purchase Tasty Tender in advance with their tickets. Tasty Tender is tip money used during the event to reward your favorite chefs. Purchasing ahead allows guests to skip the line and have it ready when the door opens. Proceeds from United We Cook directly support United Way's mission to strengthen family, youth opportunity, financial security, and community resiliency across Vermilion County, along with Fountain and Warren counties in Indiana. United Way of Danville area currently supports 20 local agencies and 27 programs. For more information or to get tickets, contact United Way through its website at unitedway.org or by email at info@unitedway.org or by phone at 217-442-3512. We're almost in the middle of our time together today, so let's take a break from the news and take a look at the death notices and obituaries that were received by Friday at 5 p.m. Gerald Kenneth Anders. Gerald K. Anders passed away March 30th at home at the age of 75. A celebration of his life will take place at 11 a.m. on Thursday, April 9th. D.O. McComb and Sons in Maplewood Park at 4017 Maplecrest Road, Fort Wayne, Indiana, are taking care of the arrangements, and there is a calling 1 hour before the service. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation to Humane Fort Wayne. Bradley Schluter. Bradley Schluter, age 49, of Danville, died at 10:08 p.m. on Tuesday, March 31st at Advocate Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge. Memorials may be made to Fox Ridge-Vet, the Arbor Day Foundation, Pheasants Forever, or an organization of the donor's choice. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on April 11th at St. Paul's Lutheran Church at 108 East Church Street. And that's in Gifford. And our final obituary today is that of Barbara Sherman. Barbara Sherman, 93, passed away on March 30th. She was born in Danville. A celebration of her life will take place on Thursday, April 9th at the H.D. Oliver Funeral Apartments, Chesapeake Chape, at 1416 Cedar Road in Chesapeake, Virginia. That concludes the reading of today's obituaries. We'll turn our attention to the editorials today. And today's headline, Celebrate Outdoors in Vermilion County. I love that it's warm enough and nice enough that we're actually willing to celebrate outside. This is a good sign, everyone. Area residents will head outside in the weeks to come as temperatures rise and the sun shines longer. Vermilion County boasts natural assets that provide a wealth of variety and beauty for people who want to spend time outside. The Vermilion County Conservation District celebrates its 60th anniversary during 2026. Voters created the organization in 1966, and its value to our community grows year after year. The district offers a variety of special summer classes for ages 3 to adult. The classes include information about local wildlife, insects, pioneer skills, canoeing, and an outdoor school for adults. The classes usually fill up quickly and sign-ups are now available. Information, registration forms, and fee schedules can be found at the district's website at vccd.org. The district offers thousands of acres for outdoor recreation among its four sites, all of which are open with no entry fee. Visitors can picnic, hike trails, visit exhibits, participate in special activities, fish, hunt, canoe, or sign up for classes linked to nature. The sites include Kennecuck County Park at 2296A Henning Road, just 5 miles or so west of Danville. The park's 3,000 acres includes three nature preserves, Lake Mingo, a 1,000-acre lake, provides those who like to fish an opportunity to try their luck. The park's western boundary features the Middle Fork National Scenic River and Middle Fork State Wildlife Area, which boasts 3,000 wilderness acres of its own. Kennecuck's Visitors Center houses an aquarium, a natural history museum, and a Native American display, all open at no charge. The park offers three buildings and four shelters to rent for gatherings or special events. The Bunker Hill Historic Area gives visitors a chance to see a number of buildings from the county's past, including a one-room schoolhouse and a chapel that can be rented for weddings. The Forest Glen Reserve at 2301 East 900 North Road, about 7 miles east of Westville, features camping, trails, a pioneer cabin, the Gannett Center for special events, as well as other buildings and shelters available to rent for special occasions. The preserve's 1,800 acres includes four nature preserves, including a 22-acre savanna restoration project. Its River Ridge Backpack Trail carries a $5 fee for hikers who want to venture out, and overnight stays are available. The Lake Vermilion Boat Ramp can be found on the lake's west side. It includes a public boat ramp, dock, and concession building, as well as picnic areas. The district's unique Heron Park is on West Newell Road, west of Illinois Route 1, north of Danville. Its wetland boardwalk allows visitors to see birds and other critters and fish that call the wetlands home. The boardwalk is accessible to those in wheelchairs as well. In addition to all the regular features, the district also serves as home to a number of special events, such as Revolutionary War and Civil War reenactments, craft demonstrations, Pack the Park in August at Kennecuck with food and music, Thanksgiving at the cabin at Forest Glen, and the annual holiday display of lights each December at the Bunker Hill Historic Area. The district also serves as a major attraction for visitors from out of the area who want to spend a day enjoying nature. It's a real asset for county residents. Join in the history's 60th anniversary and make it a point to visit one of the parks soon. We also have an article today, or a column, by the Irish hiker Kevin Cullen. And today's title is Remembering Vermilion Street History in Downtown Danville. Business buildings in downtown Danville have been in the news lately. Among others, the city plans to raise the former homes of Woodbury, Book Company, Chart Records, The Nook Restaurant, and Elliott's Candy and Coins to create more green space and parking. The buildings clearly have seen better days. One roof even collapsed. But for those of us who can remember when Vermilion was the place to shop, grab lunch, do banking, get a prescription filled, pay a water bill, or see a dentist, it's a hard pill to swallow. Let's face it, few downtowns have as many parking spaces and grassy lots as downtown Danville has. It seems a good time to recount some Vermilion Street history, culled from old copies of the Commercial News. Vermilion was one of Danville's original streets, laid out in 1827. It remained a dirt street until brick paving was installed in 1893. Franklin, Main, and Hazel Streets were paved before Vermilion was. In the early days, West Main Street was the chief commercial thoroughfare. Vermilion came into prominence between 1895 and 1900. In the old days, pieces of natural stone were laid a foot apart at intersections on Vermilion to keep people from having to step through the mud and horse manure. White-jacketed street cleaners were kept busy scraping the slabs. Horse-drawn streetcars ran up and down the middle of Vermilion for many years. Boards were laid from the sidewalks to the rail lines, allowing streetcar passengers to walk the plank and keep their shoes, trousers, and dresses out of the muck. Many of the bricks used to pave Vermilion Street came from Brazil, Indiana, a few miles east of Terre Haute. Local brickyards at the time were unable to supply the rock-hard paving bricks required, but later they produced millions of them. Downtown Vermilion Street was paved in brick until 1917, when it was covered in asphalt. Wooden paving blocks had been used in and near the courthouse square to help muffle the ear-splitting racket caused by iron wagon tires and horseshoes striking brick. Tracks for electric streetcars were removed in 1937, and the center part of the street was paved with asphalt. At that time, Vermilion was called Danville's most beautiful and modern thoroughfare. For decades, Vermilion Street carried four lanes of traffic, two northbound and two southbound. In 1966, local businessmen and civic leaders started pushing for creation of the Vermilion Park Mall between Harrison Street and Main Street. The proposal was seen as a way to revitalize downtown Danville and compete with suburban shopping centers. Construction came in 1967 with $50,000 from the city and $70,000 from more than 110 property owners and businesses. All motorized traffic was rerouted, concrete and grass replaced street paving, statues, parks, park benches, trees, and flowers were brought in. Danville's Park Mall was a big deal at the time. It was the first outdoor downtown shopping mall in Illinois, and people drove miles to see it, and many cities copied it. The 1967 downtown mall plan was never completed. The mall was supposed to extend south on Vermilion to South Street, then east and west on Main to Hazel and Walnut Streets. And the city insisted on keeping parking meters, another turnoff for people who could park free at Kmart. Over time, it became clear that the mall wasn't all that it was cracked up to be. Businesses struggled, shoppers complained, maintenance was a headache, and professional offices left. In 1987, it was torn out to create two traffic lanes with parking on both sides. When the three-story building at 125 North Vermilion Street is raised, and a unique bit of history will go with it. On February 15, 1915, the Woodbury Box Company building, constructed in 1889, caught fire. Two Danville firefighters were crushed to death when a wall fell on them. In November 1915, a new Woodbury Book Company building opened on the same site. It still contains part of brick walls that survived the fire. If those walls could talk, they'd tell a story of courage and tragedy that should never be forgotten. And this article came to us again by Kevin Cullen, the Irish Hiker. Well, it's been an exciting weekend of basketball as we are finishing up March Madness. In today's headline, Four Looking for More. After Elite Eight stunner, UConn chases third title in 4 years. And this comes to us by reporter Daniel Suddeth. They've survived four rounds of March Madness, but the ultimate test awaits in Indianapolis as a new NCAA men's basketball king will be crowned at Lucas Oil Stadium. Number one seeds Arizona and Michigan join number two Connecticut and number three Illinois in the quest for the title beginning Saturday. The Fighting Illini are the only program in the Final Four without a championship under their belt. Last year's title winner, Florida, failed to make it to Indianapolis, meaning a new champion will emerge from this year's field. Saturday's first game pits Illinois against UConn. The Huskies have won two out of the last three championships and are seeking their program's seventh overall title. They're coming off the tournament's most memorable moment when Braylon Mullins sank a deep three-pointer late in the Huskies' Elite Eight contest against Duke to send UConn to the Final Four. Illinois advanced after freshman guard Keaton Wagler scored 25 points against Iowa to send the Fighting Illini to their first Final Four since 2005. Both teams feature balanced defensive attacks, along with Wagler, Andres Tojokovic, and David Mirkovic have been major contributors for Illinois. The Fighting Illini have a deep bench, especially when it comes to their forefront. Terrace Reed Jr. is coming off a 26.9 rebound performance against Duke. He scored in double digits every game of the tournament, including a 31.27 rebound outing against Furman. Senior Alex Carabin, a member of the 23 and 24 UConn title teams, has studied the Huskies all season. Though he was held to just 5 points against Duke, he's averaging 17.7 points per game in the big dance. Illinois coach Brad Underwood is making his first trip to the Final Four, while UConn Danny Hurley is seeking his third title in 4 seasons. Saturday's nightcap features two heavyweights and number one seeds Arizona and Michigan. The Wildcats returned to the Final Four for the first time since 2001, while it was 2018 when the Wolverines last played in the final weekend. Despite the recent droughts, Michigan and Arizona have enjoyed remarkable seasons. Arizona last lost on February 14th in overtime to Texas Tech, and Michigan enters the Final Four the winner of 10 out of its last 11 games. Two freshmen key Arizona's offense, in guard Braden Burris and forward Koa Pete. Burris led the Wildcats in scoring and is averaging just shy of 18 points per game in the tournament. Pete has been a force in the paint and heads to Indianapolis after scoring 20 points and grabbing 7 rebounds against Purdue in the Elite Eight. Another freshman, Ivan Karkchenov, adds 18 points and 8 rebounds against the Boilermakers. The Wildcats balance their freshman star power with experience. Senior Toby Awaka averages just less than a double-double with a 9.3 points per game and a 9.1 rebounds per game. Big Ten Player of the Year Yaxel Lendeborg leads Michigan with the Final Four. The senior forward is averaging 21 points per game in the tournament and scored 27 against Tennessee in the Elite Eight. Lendeborg anchors a dominant Wolverine front court that also features Merez Johnson Jr. and Ade Mara. Michigan point guard Elliot Cadu has set the table for the Wolverine big men. The junior has 10 assists against Tennessee, and he's averaging 8.3 APG in the big dance. Arizona's Tommy Lloyd and Michigan's Dusty Mays are seeking their first national titles as coaches. Well, by now I'm sure you know that the winners of those two games were UConn and Michigan, and we are looking forward to that final game. The Illini, you had a great year. Thanks for giving us something to cheer about. Well, we are winding down our time together. Again, I hope you all had a very blessed Easter Sunday and Easter week for that matter. Let's take a look at our 7-day forecast for Danville. This comes to us from AccuWeather. Monday, it's supposed to be sunny, mostly sunny and breezy with a high of 54, low of 29. Tuesday, it's the coldest day of our week, partly sunny and chilly at 49 degree high with a 37 low. Wednesday, though, we're back at a high of 64 with a partly sunny and breezy day, mostly cloudy on Thursday with a high of 70. And Friday's got some rains and a rainstorm in it, gosh darn it, right before the weekend again, with a high of 70 and a low of 50 degrees. And these temperatures, boy, they are kind of right on line with what we expect this time of year. Our normal high and low is 60 degrees with a 38 degree low. So looks like we're right in the mix. This has been Terry Burdick reading with you today for the Danville Commercial News. I look forward to reading again with you soon. Have a great week.